Last year, they started a new feature down here in Warbirds, and that's the tram, right, Glenn?
Yeah, that's correct, Jeff.
So, Glenn, you're from Toronto, and you're a pilot. You fly the P-51, T-34, and a bunch of the Warbirds, which makes you the perfect candidate to be a narrator on a tour of the Warbird area. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a little fantasy tram tour here, if you will.
Okay.
If you would just take us from the start and run us through Warbirds just as you would as if we were on the tram. And we got to mention that it's not easy to get on this tram, is it?
No, it's not. We're limited to about, I think it's 32 or 36 seats. So we've been we run the tram tours from 9 to 3 on the hour. The tours run about 40 minutes. And 30 minutes prior to each tour, we'll be handing out tickets on a first-come, first-served basis. And this is just to ensure that the folks who got there first get their shot at a seat. And we start over in the training command area, and we do have some signs there to show you where to go to get your tickets. And it's a free tour. It's sponsored by Warbirds of America and a couple of the other supporters of Warbirds. And it was designed, like you said, we started this last year. We weren't sure how it was going to work out. We started off just doing a couple tours. We planned maybe two or three a day, depending on the response. The response was overwhelming, actually, and we started to expand the number of trips we did. And it was Rick Siegfried was the spark plug behind it last year to get it going, and it was as a means to introduce Warbirds to a broader audience. You know, people would come up to the Warbirds and ask questions about this and that, and, you know, what do you guys do? Who are you? And so that was sort of the genesis of the program.
Glenn, where do they go if they want to get on the tram?
There's an area called Training Command where we have a number of the training aircraft. There's a big white tent. It is on just the west side of the Scott Warbird Alley. And we do have some signs up that went up this morning to guide folks where to get the tickets. Right now the folks are wearing volunteer t-shirts that are blue that say Welcome Warbirds. And folks can get their tickets from there.
And it's called the Warbird Express Tram.
It is indeed, yes.
Okay, so we have 10 minutes.
Minutes for the 40-minute tour.
That's it. So, but we don't have to stop anywhere.
We don't.
It's a virtual tour.
We keep it moving the whole time. Well, let me tell you a little bit about our thought process and what we do. And if we have some time, then we can talk specifically about some of the things we say. Part of what we are trying to do is introduce folks to Warbirds, who we are, what we're all about, what we do. There's still, I think, a perception out there. I've come across this every year that I've been here as I travel through, you know, the convention site, that to be a Warbird member, you either have to own a Warbird or fly a Warbird. And that's just not so. The majority of our members are neither Warbird owners or Warbird operators. They're enthusiasts. It's, you know, it's about the history and helping support the organization to keep these aircraft flying. So we talked a little bit about that. We also don't like to get too technical because not everybody here is technically oriented, as I'm also a mechanic. I've restored and maintained a lot of these airplanes. So if you want to talk compression ratios and nose gear reduction ratios, you know, we can talk about that anytime. But on the tour, we want to keep people engaged and keep them interested. When it comes down to, for example, training command, we have PT aircraft, BT aircraft, AT aircraft. Well, what does that mean? Folks in aviation who grew up with this, well, we know exactly what that means. So we start off by defining what these terms are. We have primary trainers, basic trainers, advanced trainers. And we go over the roles that each aircraft would play in training a pilot for their eventual assignment, whether it's going to be on a fighter or a bomber or transport. And we have all the ATs in the training commander area, which makes that part easy. If you were going the multi-engine route, the Cessna Bobcat, the Bamboo Bomber, is out on the flight line, so it gives us an opportunity to talk about that aircraft and its role in training the multi-engine pilots. So as we go through the various areas, we'll try and talk about, for example, in the liaison area, you know, what is a liaison aircraft? What is an L-Bird? Why does that aircraft with all the windows look a lot like my buddy's Ronca Champ, but it looks a lot the same, but it's a little bit different? So we'll talk about why that is, and the military use of these aircraft, and why a lot of the civilian-type airplanes that we see on the field, certainly in the Warbird area, have stars and bars on them, and why they were drafted and put into military service. So we try to tell the story as opposed to getting technical about, you know, numbers and weights, etc. And, of course, we have our living history group, which is our little time capsule, which I just love walking through there. and talking with the folks and seeing seeing how they live. I don't even want to say see the displays, because I mean the whole encampment is a display, and it's just fascinating to talk to the folks there as well.
So so we're on the tour. You actually go through the encampment with the tram?
No, we don't actually go through. It's not that large, but it's right against the it's right up against the access road where the tram goes out to get over to the northern part of the Warbird area. So we do drive by it, and they have an opportunity to see it and see the encampment and everybody busy doing what they do.
Sounds good. So 7 minutes. What can you tell us?
All right. Well, we start off in the training command area, and we start off with our introduction and welcome everybody on board, and just sort of by a show of hands ask how many veterans are on board, because I think it's important to honor the veterans who did serve our country. And then we like to ask how many EA members are on board, and if hopefully we'll get a few hands, and of that we'll ask about Warbirds. And usually there's one or two, sometimes there's none, so we say, okay, well, we're going to talk to you about Warbirds and why we're here, what we're doing, and hopefully you try and encourage some folks to come and join us. And then we'll start talking about some of the training aircraft. And there's currently in the training command, we have a very pretty PT-19 that just came out of the restoration shop. And there's also the Boeing Sturman, the PT-17, both primary trainers. And we're often asked, okay, so this is a primary trainer, that's a primary trainer. Well, how would you determine who would fly what? Well, that was just based on the training base. There was no rhyme or reason. The various manufacturers were producing this aircraft to meet the demand of the military at that time. So we'll talk about the primary trainers. This is where pilots would learn how to fly. And that was your basic flying program. If you graduated that program...
It was a Cessna 150 of the military, basically.
Pretty much, exactly. And later on, the Cessna 172 was known as the T-41. And so pilots in the Air Force in more modern time would get their first 25 or 30 hours in the Cessna. So you're exactly right. So once you've learned how to fly, now you need to go learn some more advanced skills. This is where you get into the basic trainers, the BT, like the BT-13. You're starting to get more systems, more complex. The PT-19, for example, has manual flaps, but a fixed-pitch propeller doesn't control. The BT-13 now introduces a controllable pitch propeller, a little more complex systems. The basic trainers is where you would learn how to your basic aerobatics and formation training. And once you get through that program, if you were destined for fighters, you would go on to the advanced trainer, which in this case would be the T-6.
A little bit more modern military airplane there. We have a jet fighter taking off right here on the runway next to us. So we'll continue the tram tour here once he's left the area. Sounds like a Harrier to me.
Some people just have no consideration for live radio.
I know.
Did you see what it was?
I think it's a Harrier, Bill.
No, that was the Fury.
Oh, was it Fury?
Yeah. One of the noisiest airplanes in the world other than the Harrier.
it had to be a Harrier or something very near it with that loud noise. Yeah.
Definitely the Fury.
That's a one of a kind. As far as I know, that's the only one that's still flying.
Yes, I think you're right there, Bill. Oh, lost my train of thought. Yes, we were into the advanced trainers.
We were talking about aerobatics.
The BT, the basic trainers is where you would learn your aerobatics and your initial formation skills. From there, if you were destined to fly a fighter, you would go on to the AT-6. And the AT-6, of course, probably one of the most numerous warbirds, about 550 or so still flying, redesignated just the T-6 after World War II, because that became the primary, the basic, and the advanced trainer after the war. Still was used throughout the world by many, many countries. The Spanish retired theirs in 1982. There was a fellow named Ray Stutzman brought many of those into the country. And a lot of the current T-6s flying are Spanish. The South African Air Force actually used T-6s through 1996. And there are quite a few of them on the field here today as well. So from the training command, we'd go move to Fighter Town. And that's where the majority of the fighters that come to Oshkosh are parked. And the majority of them being P-51D Mustangs. And the reason I emphasize the D is this week we have a very rare variant of the Mustang known the A-36 Apache. And what most people may not realize is the Mustang came about because the British Purchasing Commission came to North American Aviation back in 1940 and asked them to produce Curtiss P-40s under license. Curtiss, full production, meeting the demand of the Army Air Corps and plus the British contracts. And they needed fighters faster. They went to North American, and the folks there said, well, you know, we've been looking at some research that the organization now known as NASA has been doing in airfoil research. And using the same engine prop, armament configuration, or radio configuration that you want for the P-40, we believe we can build you a better airplane if you'll let us. 117 days later, what eventually became known as the Mustang was rolled out the door. The first variant that was produced for the U.S. service was the A-36 Apache, which was actually a ground attack slash dive bomber. And this particular aircraft has dive flaps on it, which they display during the day in the extended position. Only 500 were produced, only 3 survive, and 2 of those are actually airworthy, this being the second one.
Wow. So it is rare to see this airplane.
It's very rare. It actually just got its first flight last month, and it's only been flying for about 3-4 weeks now. So this is its first public appearance. We'll talk a little bit about the genesis of the Mustang to its, what we know as the D model. The original airplanes flew with Allison engines, which are a great engine, but they only were not designed for high-altitude use. As the bombers, our bombers were flying farther and farther into Europe, we needed an aircraft that could fly all the way and support the bombers. Due to the Mustang's internal fuel capacity compared to its contemporaries, and the mating of the high-altitude version of the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, plus normally 75-gallon drop tanks, the Mustang now had the range to fly into the heart of Germany and back. And roughly about a gallon a minute fuel burn for a Mustang in a normal cruise configuration. So with all the fuel tanks, internal fuel is 245 gallons plus another 150 under the wings, gave it enough of an endurance to complete the mission.
Wow, that's impressive. Well, Glenn, we would encourage everybody to come down and try and get on your tram tour. It sounds like it's a really great tour. How long does it last?
The tours are averaging about 40 minutes. It's, like I say, just a general conversation with the folks on some of the history of the aircraft, the training roles, the fighter aircraft. We cover the whole field here with the bombers, the transports, the jets, and the heavier trainers like the T-28s that are parked on the runway there. And we'll finish off around the Warbird Alley, Scott's Warbird Alley, where some of the more interesting aircraft are parked. And then we finish off back at the Warbird Merchandise and Membership Tent, where we encourage folks to join Warbirds of America and help support us in keeping these aircraft flying.
And it is easy to do. It's easy to join Warbirds of America. They've got booths over here. You can go online and do it through EAA.org, through Warbirds
Absolutely.
Of America. And if you're already an EAA member, it's just one click and off you go.
And you're there.
And it's a great magazine. I love the magazine. Anyway, Bill, Glenn, thank you very much for joining us on EAA Radio.
Just let everybody know. Come on in. The water's fine.